Welcome to another HBS Working Knowledge podcast. I'm Jim Eisner. The United States ranks high on many economic indicators, but personal savings isn't one of them. According to recent figures, Europeans saved, on average, about 20% of household disposable income. The Japanese, about 25%, and the Chinese, a whopping 50%. In contrast, however, the U.S. savings rate is minus 0.6%, down from 11.1% in 1985. Not surprisingly, the problem is particularly acute among the poor. To look at this more closely, my guest today is Peter Tufano, the Sylvan C. Coleman Professor of Financial Management at Harvard Business School. Can you flesh out for us a bit the state of family finances in this country?
Sure, Jim. That's a big question. There's lots of ways to approach it. The Federal Reserve, for example, would say that as of the end of October, U.S. households had $67 trillion in assets, about $27 trillion in their homes, about $40 trillion in financial assets. They had $13 trillion in home mortgages and a little bit less than $3 trillion in credit cards. All those aggregate statistics are correct, but they don't really tell the full story of family finances because, at least the work that I've been doing, it's not about all families or even the average family, but about certain kinds of families, most American families, that these numbers have to be looked at more carefully.
And why are Americans such bad savers?
Well, I think it's because we're such good consumers. I think that's the short and the long of it. The recent national data would suggest that, as you said, the savings rate's about negative 0.6%, which is considerably below where it's been in the past and considerably below where it is in other countries. And I do believe that to a large part, it reflects the fact that we are such good consumers and that American business does such a great job in encouraging us to consume.
Now, one of the focal points of your research, Peter, has been lower-income families. Mm-hmm. Can you define that term for us?
Many people use lower or lower and moderate income populations or families differently. Some poverty scholars, for example, will define that as, say, 200% of the poverty line. That would put a family of four at about $32,000. Others might say it's median or below. That's family income of $45,000 or less. The work that I tend to do, I think it's fair to say, addresses the needs of really lower and moderate income consumers. Our sweet spot in the research and in the advocacy work that we do is, I would say, relevant to people who make $50,000 and less, which is slightly north of what, for example, a poverty scholar would consider to be lower income.
And can you give us some sense of the net worth of these lower to median income families?
So net worth is an interesting concept, but I think a more relevant one for the research that we do and the work that I do is really about savings in particular. So everybody looks at income distributions. Mm-hmm. An alternative would be to look at wealth distributions. But rather than look at a distribution, some scholars have created a measure of asset poverty, which I find relatively compelling. So it asks the simple question, if you were to live at the poverty line, so not at your current level of spending, but at the poverty line, how long could you live with your existing assets? And for 40 to 50% of American families, that answer is under 6 months. Mm. So, in fact, if my memory holds correct, I think it's actually under 4 months. So, but it's not a very long time. So a large number of American families, even families who look relatively well-to-do, if their income sources were suddenly cut off, loss of wages or income, and they had to live on their savings, would find that they would be out of savings almost immediately, within weeks if not months. There are other statistics that would show that a meaningful fraction of Americans have under $100 in financial assets. While one can look at the big numbers, the aggregate numbers, the macro numbers, it's these family-level statistics that are more troubling to me.
There's a certain paradox here. As low as the savings rate is in the United States, and you referred to it earlier, these very families, the lower income portion of the demographic, if you will, they want to save, but they have trouble doing that. Why is that? Well, beyond the fact that they don't have a lot of money to begin with.
Well, the want to comes as a surprise to many. Policymakers and even business people will make the assumption that low-income families are not interested in savings. It's not true at all. And I think the reason why it is, you would know immediately if you went and talked to some people. Mm. I come from relatively modest means. My family saved a lot. They knew they had to save because their only hope of getting me to college was the fact that they put some money away. If you talk to many families, they feel the same kind of pressure. They want to take care of their families, to buy a house, to put their kids in school, to make sure that they have money for emergencies. And they don't have the luxury of having large assets in the form of stock or other things that they can liquidate if some trouble comes along. So their incentives to save are pretty high. There has been research done, pioneered by Michael Sheridan at Washington University in St. Louis, developing a program called Individual Development Accounts. These are 401k-like accounts for low-income families, and there the findings are that the families with the least income actually saved at the highest rates. And again, it doesn't come as a surprise. They know that savings is really important.
What about banks, though? Is there a feeling that banks don't actually want these folks as customers?
Well, I don't think it's fair to just point at banks. I think it's fair to say that financial institutions, in general, find hard, given their current business models, find it hard to make money off these customers. Mm. Now, if you think about the equation that governs whether you make money or not, there's a size of an account, and then there's kind of a spread you make on the account, plus any fees you can charge, less your cost of operation. So, you know, the cost of handling an account, a big account or a small account, may be relatively the same. The cost of acquiring an account may be relatively high. And then when you look at a number, you know, a relatively small account size, the economics just don't work terribly well in order to serve low-income families. So, for example, I don't think that the major mutual fund companies are discriminatory in any way. But if you go to the largest mutual fund companies, you'll find that they will put minimum initial balances on their accounts of $2,500 to $3,000. It's not because they don't like low-income families who only have $1,500 saved, but rather given their cost structures. They can't find a way to make money at those low balance levels. However, the fact that they're set up that way doesn't mean they couldn't be set up differently, or there might be other innovations that can actually serve this population, which is a lot of what I'm interested in.
So let's talk a bit now about some of the alternatives that you've been thinking about and working on in the past few years.
Sure. So if you want to help families save, then you have to go where the money is. Kind of like if you want to fish, you have to go where the fish are. So where is the money in low-income communities? And as it turns out, one of the places, or maybe not places, but times, when families are relatively flush is tax time. The federal government gave out last year over $220 billion of refunds to American families. $100 billion went to families who made under $40,000 a year. $80 billion went to families who made under $30,000 a year. So tax time is when these large refunds roll into these communities. And if you think about the size of an average refund, an earned income tax credit recipient, and EITC is the primary government program that delivers these large programs, these large refunds, will get a refund check on average of about $1,700. That's a lot of money if you're making $12,000 or $15,000. Mm-hmm. It's probably the largest single check that you've gotten in a year. It certainly is the largest jump ball in terms of you haven't pre-committed it for your rent or for paying bills. Merchants have figured this out. And if you look at patterns of merchandising, there are promotions, all kinds of direct mail activities, and other kinds of sales activities to try to capitalize on refund time. So, for example, in some places, you can go to an auto dealer and they will fill out your taxes for free. Why? Because after it's filled out, then they can take the refund and use that as a deposit or a down payment for your car. My favorite story is I was giving a seminar on April 16th last year, and I have one of these little cell phones that, you know, get messages on them, and there was a message from Travelocity saying, got a big refund, go on a trip. Mm-hmm. Every marketer knows that if you want to sell stuff to, you know, refund recipients, this early time of year is a great time to sell product. Unfortunately, not very many people were focused on how is it that you could help people save or families save at this time. So the first project that we did was to ask a relatively simple question. How can you lean against the wind, as it were, and help families at refund time save? And as it turns out, there's a small plumbing problem that the IRS had. And the plumbing problem is this. They would send a refund to one destination. So one check, paper check, or one electronic deposit. Doesn't sound like a bad problem, but let's analogize that to a paycheck. Suppose that I give you your paycheck, and then I say, Jim, go do with it whatever you want. You can spend some, put some in your 401k if you think about it, put some in the bank if you think about it, but it's your problem. We know that doesn't work. You know, ever since Ben Franklin, people have been talking about pay yourself first. And pay yourself first would indicate, well, you should siphon some money off before you start to spend. But the structure of the tax rules didn't allow that. So we went on the ground in Tulsa, Oklahoma, 2 years ago now, and we tested whether or not if you offered this product to families, A, whether they'd use it, and whether it would help them save. We actually created the product. We did the legal and IT infrastructure to do this. And lo and behold, we found that about a quarter of the refund recipients wanted to use an opportunity to split their refund before they got the money. In fact, they'd be willing to pay for that. And they were very happy about it. They felt it helped them manage their money better. Fortunately, some legislators and folks in Washington who had been talking about this idea of split refunds actually picked up on our research and used that to kind of advance this idea. And I was pleased to be in Washington in May when Commissioner Everson of the IRS announced that there would be a new change in tax policy, Form 8888, which would allow people to save their refunds to multiple destinations. And that form went live on January 1st. It's a small step towards being able to help families save at tax time.
Now, you've also taken a new look at an old chestnut, the U.S. savings bond.
Right.
How is that going to work?
Well, the why, you know, you'd asked me before, why aren't banks clamoring to get money from low-income families? And it's because they can't make any money from them, or because for a variety of good reasons, they just choose not to do business there. So we were looking for a savings vehicle that was accessible to everyone, a universal savings vehicle with low fees, low risk, available anywhere, portable. It turns out it's existed all the time. It was called U.S. savings bonds. Unfortunately, the Treasury has been, in effect, phasing out the savings bond program. And I wrote a piece in 2005 strongly encouraging them not to do that. In particular, in the 1960s, they used to allow you to check off a box on your refund and direct some of your direct your entire refund into the purchase of savings bonds. We thought that with the advent of split refunds, there might be people who'd like to do that. It turns out that about 90% of Americans know about savings bonds, mm-hmm. and about 55 million Americans own them, even this product that hasn't been marketed in years. And so we are in the field right now, as we speak, in Boston and in Illinois, offering savings bonds to about 60,000 families at tax time, asking the simple question, would you like some savings bonds with your refund? And we will know at the end of the tax season whether they do or not. Preliminary results suggest that, you know, that old chestnut still has a lot of life in it. And once we bring it back to life, there's lots of interesting innovations that one can do, not only with the product, but with the marketing of that product, to make it an even more effective vehicle for family savings.
Talking about an even older chestnut, something having to do with a lottery bond
yes.
comes to mind from your research as well.
So I am particularly passionate about, maybe that's not the right word, but very interested in a product that's existed since 1694, continuously offered in the UK since 1956, and it goes by various names. Lottery-linked savings, prize-linked savings, in the UK it's called a premium savings bond. And the structure is really simple. Imagine a bond or a bank account where your money is liquid at all times. You can therefore take it out when you need it. Second of all, your principal is never at risk. And if you think about those first two characteristics, they're key to an emergency saver. And if you ask people why they save, 20% are saving for emergencies. They're not saving for highfalutin purposes. It's emergencies that matter. But it has this third element, which is what gives it all the juice, basically, which is that instead of us all earning interest, what we, in a sense, do in essence do is we throw all the money on a table and then somebody wins it. In the UK, for example, each month, 2 to 5 people win £1 million. And the more you save, the more you win. So this product is unfortunately against the law in the United States because states have chosen to fund themselves using lotteries, a particularly regressive tax, and an interesting public policy question. We are currently offering the product in Indiana, and I did say it was illegal, but we're offering it in a form that is legal, at least our lawyers tell us that, at least as a test. And we're very curious to know whether this product helps families save. We suspect that it will because it combines this cocktail of low risk, high liquidity with the potential to win. A recent Consumer Federation of America survey suggested that a large number of Americans think they're more likely to actually collect money by playing the lottery than by saving. You know, we're trying to leverage that mentality, for good or for bad, to help families save. And we'll know whether or not it works after we test it out.
And you've also gotten involved in this in another way through an entrepreneurial venture of your own called Doorway to Dream, the Doorway to Dreams Foundation.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us briefly about what that involves.
Sure. Most of the work that I do, or much of the work that I do, requires not just thinking about things, but actually getting out into the field and testing things. And so I founded D2D, Doorways to Dreams, about 2000, because we needed a mechanism where we could actually test products. We work with typically large firms as our partners. They do all the heavy work. We're, in essence, an R&D lab and a new product lab for them. And then I'm able to test things in the field.
Now, you've also been involved with a research agenda that involves not only Harvard Business School faculty, but faculty across all of Harvard University and even beyond Harvard.
Mm-hmm.
You've had a preliminary meeting here already. Tell us a little bit about what you have planned for the future and what kind of impact you hope to have beyond what you've already done.
So you're right that this work extends beyond the borders of Harvard Business School. And so this past fall, we assembled researchers from around the university. And it's interesting. On the question of consumer finance, we have people at the business school who care deeply about this. There are folks in the economics department, at the Kennedy School, at the law school, and the Joint Center on Housing. But as it turns out, we've never gotten together to talk to one another, to actually join forces. So what we did this fall was to get together not only those folks, but also academics from other schools, business people, consumer advocates, regulators, and even some funders in the foundation space to talk about not what we did know, but what we don't know. So most conferences that you go to, the agenda is let's hear a paper about something we do know. So this conference was decidedly different. It was, for each session, let's talk about the things that we need to know that would change a policymaker's decision or a business person's decision or even a consumer advocate's decision, but we just don't know. And therefore, it would be very promising for research to be directed towards that. So that first meeting was really an agenda-setting meeting. And as a result of that, I know that a number of new partnerships and collaborations around research have been formed, and I'd like to think that some of those will bear fruit in research and new business products and new ways of thinking about policy in the future.
Well, we wish you well in these ventures, and thank you for coming in.
Thank you.